stop, 24 hours a day.
Worship Radio 247. Worship Radio 247.
As promised, beloved, I am going to bring you the Andrew White documentary right now. I have known Andrew personally for some years now, ever since meeting him on the set of God TV's In-Depth series, when he revealed to me, just before the cameras started turning, that he owned three mobile phones, two of which he could happily switch off. However, the last remaining cell phone needed to stay on because of international political wrangling going on in the Middle East and had to be contacted easily. We began turning film, and within 5 minutes of the first program, his cell shrilled. "Carry on turning over," I signaled to the gallery, so that we could eavesdrop a little on his conversation. It was very clear that he was speaking to some highly ranked government official in Israel. It turned out to be the Deputy Foreign Minister of Israel. Such are Andrew's connections all around the world. As you listen to this powerful documentary about Andrew's life and work, I pray you will be blessed and will spare him a thought from time to time as you begin to understand the man behind the title of the Vicar of Baghdad. I'm David Aldous. Andrew, welcome to My Life in His Hands. I want to start with looking at your early years, and you refer to this quite extensively in the book, Suffer the Children. Mm. Tell me about your early years and what prompted you to write this book.
Well, the reason the book is written is because I'm always asked, why is it you're so long in Iraq? It's really dangerous for you. And I say, I'm there, the thing which helps me most is my children. And when I say my children, I mean all the children there. Mm. They call me daddy, most of them had their fathers killed. Mm. And so I thought it'd be good to write a book about the children and with the children. And they write their various stories, what they have experienced and what they have suffered throughout the war. And in that book, I actually begin by telling my own story of childhood and what I personally experienced, and then go on to their present case.
What was your childhood like?
Well, I was brought up in a very Christian household. I was brought up between the strict Baptists and the Pentecostals. Now, that doesn't happen very often. And I remember my teacher at school saying to me at the age of 10, she said to all the class, "What do you want to do when you grow up?" So I said to my teacher, as you do when you're 10, I said, "I want to be an anaesthetist and a priest." And she said to me, "You can only do one thing, and you can't be a priest because they don't have priests in your church." So I started visiting an elderly lady who was an avid Anglican, and her priest used to come every week and bring her communion. She was bedridden. So I became an Anglican. It was my only thing I did as regards childhood rebellion. And I thought I could kind of hold together my strict Baptist doctrine and my charismatic history of Pentecostalism. And then I...
Which meant then that surely that you could go into the Anglican church and lift your hands up.
Yeah, exactly. The only way I could hold it all together was to be an Anglican.
Yeah, yeah.
So I remember going on school later and saying to my teacher that I wanted to do anaesthetics and be a priest, and he said, "You will." Mm. And she had said to me no before. And I went and did my medical training at St. Thomas's Hospital in London. And I specialised in anaesthetics. I read my first book in anaesthetics when I was 10. Mm. You know, other children were reading the Beano and the Dandy, and I was reading the Synopsis of Anesthesia.
Just as an aside now, I was just wondering whether your working of anesthesia in hospital has helped in your preaching. Do you send people to sleep?
Well, it's a lot quicker with drugs. But you can put people to sleep in sermons as well. Mm. But it takes a little bit longer.
Let me talk about your mum and your dad. What sort of parents were they?
My parents were very good, very, very Christian. Mm. And my father was Anglo-Indian, my mother completely English. My father was a strict Baptist one, my mother was the Pentecostal one. And we were brought up in a very loving Christian household.
Schooling, what about school?
School was good. I wasn't brilliant until later on. Took a few years to become really good.
And where did you go to school?
I went to school in Kent.
Okay. What sort of school was it?
It was a quite a normal school.
No, I mean, was it a public school? Was it a state school? What sort of school did you go to?
I went to both.
Okay.
At different times, not at the same time.
Mm. And how did you find your school days when you look back?
They were good, yeah. School days were fine. I was the head boy for 2 years, not 1 year. And I was quite rigorous with the other students. I expected very high standards from them.
Mm.
And I remember my head of sixth form telling me one day, "Andrew, you are a dictator." And I said, "Mr. Amos, I'm only trying to maintain order." I did his funeral last year.
Wow.
He was a great person. He really inspired me. He was one of the people who said you would achieve everything. And it was quite funny because his daughter, he was the first black head of a sixth form in England. And his daughter became the head of the House of Lords,
good
Baroness Valerie Amos.
That's amazing.
And I'm still a very good friend of hers, and she's number two at the UN now.
As I went down in the river to pray, studying about that good old way, and who shall wear the starry crown, good Lord, show me the way. Oh, mothers, let's go down, come on, mothers, let's go down, down in the river to pray. As I went down in the river to pray, studying about that good old way, and who shall wear the starry crown, good Lord, show me the way. Oh, fathers, let's go down, come on down. Come on, fathers, let's go down, down in the river to pray.
Let's talk now about the Middle East and your work in the Middle East. I know we're going to take a bit of a leap, but there's a reason for this. What prompted you to begin working in the Middle East, Andrew?
Well, it all began when I was a student at Cambridge doing my ordination training. I was studying Judaism. That was my initial introduction. And I used to go to the Jewish synagogue. I was the only Christian there. And one day the Christian Union decided to try and convert the Jews to Christianity.
Mm.
And the Jewish students at the synagogue came to me and said, can you help us? Mm. So that was the introduction to my reconciliation work and the introduction to Middle Eastern affairs. I went to Israel, I studied there at the Hebrew University in an ultra-Orthodox Jewish yeshiva. And then I got more involved in the study of Islam as well. And then I was ordained and became a curate and then a vicar.
And that's how it all began?
Yeah, then I got the job being the director of the International Centre for Reconciliation based at Coventry Cathedral. Mm. And when I was there, I said, so much of Coventry's reconciliation work had been looking backwards to the war, and when Coventry Cathedral was bombed on the 14th of November 1940, and I said, we need to look forward, and the biggest issue today is the Middle East. And so I started working in Israel and Palestine and Iraq, and it was difficult to actually start those procedures.
Tell me about your relationship with Yasser Arafat. I know you had quite a warm relationship with him during his life.
I knew him extremely well, and admittedly, I'm very pro-Jewish, I'm very pro-Israel, and I hadn't really seen him very positively. And then my little boy, Jacob, every night when I said his prayers when I was in England, he prayed for mummy, daddy, grandma, granny, papa, and Yasser Arafat. He didn't call him Yasser Arafat. He called him Yes Sir Arafat. And I asked God one day, what do you want me to do about this? And I felt him say, love your enemies. Mm. And I then got to see him several times, and he in the end became a very close friend of mine. And I used to take messages between the Israeli Prime Minister, who at that time was Aaron Sharon, and Yasser Arafat.
That's amazing. There's a story that you once told me that is so wonderful, when you went to see Yasser Arafat, apparently, and as you walked into the room, he said, Andrew, tell me about Jesus. Tell me that story.
Well, he actually was the same time as the movie came out. What was it about?
The Passion of the Christ.
Passion of the Cross.
Passion of the Christ, Mel Gibson.
Mel Gibson's, yes. And I got it for $1 in Baghdad. And I gave it to him to watch. But the really amazing story, even now, was when my little boy wanted to invite him to his birthday party. I said, who do you want to come to your birthday party? He said, just my friend. I said, who's your friend? He said, you know. I said, who? He said, Yes Sir Arafat. I said, write him an invitation card and I'll take it to him next week when I see him. That week, the Israelis blew up the Makata where he lived, and I was the only one allowed in to see him. And I spent 3 or 4 hours with him, and at the end of it, I said, oh, by the way, Rice, present in Arabic, my little boy wants you to come to his birthday party, and he prays for you every week. And I gave him the invitation to Jacob's birthday party. And Yasser Arafat literally had tears rolling down his face. He couldn't believe it that a little boy not only invited him to his birthday party, but prayed for him every night. So he sent Adariakat out of the room and he came back with one of his kafirs, his headscarf, and he wrote on it to Jacob, "Happy birthday from Yasser Arafat." And after that day, they talked to each other regularly on the phone. The following year, Jacob invited them again to his birthday party. And then the following year, Yasser Arafat said, "Bring him to me, we'll have the birthday party here." So he phoned up one night just before to see the arrangements were on. So I shouted out, "Jacob, it's President Arafat for you." And Jacob shouted back, "Tell him I'm busy, I'll call him later. He was watching The Simpsons." And so we did take him out to have his birthday party with him in Ramallah. He got ill and died. And Jacob cried and cried, "My friend has died."
Eternal Father, I offer you the body and the blood, soul and divinity of your dearly beloved Son, our Lord Jesus Christ, in atonement for our sins and those of the whole world.
For the sake of his sorrowful passion,
have mercy on us and on the whole world.
For the sake of his sorrowful passion,
have mercy on us and on the whole world.
For the sake of his sorrowful
sorrowful passion,
have mercy on us and on the whole world.
For the sake of a sorrowful passion,
have mercy on us and on the whole world.
Have mercy on us.
Have mercy.
Let's move on to Iraq now.
Mm.
Now, you began to go there when? On a regular basis, I'm
talking started about. Going there in 1998, and it was quite difficult getting in. I had a terrible situation. I tried through the embassy and the ambassador, and they said, no, we don't want you to come. We don't want you to do anything but stop sanctions. So, in the end, do you know what I did? I prayed about it.
Mm.
It was the last thing I did. I got my staff together in Coventry Cathedral. We prayed, and the next day a thanks came from Tariq Aziz inviting me in next Thursday at 5 o'clock. So that was the beginning, and I then took all the key religious leaders from England to Iraq. And then Tariq Aziz said to me, can you take our religious leaders to America and England? I said, England's no problem. The Archbishop of Canterbury will help us. I'm not so sure about America because I don't have the connection. Tariq Aziz said to me, oh, don't worry about America. Ask Billy Graham. So I asked Billy Graham. He said, yes. And I taught these religious leaders in 1998 to see Billy Graham in America and the Archbishop of Canterbury in England. And today, they are the same people we're still working with.
That is incredible. So, you're in Iraq in 98. You begin to go there on a regular basis. I mean, if we look right up to date, you're actually in Iraq, I believe, 3 weeks out of every month or thereabouts. So you spend a great deal of time.
Well, sometimes it's a lot more than that. Mm. I'm there, I've just been there for 2 months, and then I'm back for 6 days, and then I return again.
Mm. That must be very, very hard on your family. I'm going to talk about that later. What I want to talk about, really, is your book, Faith Under Fire. Now, that's all really about the situation in Iraq. What I want to come to first, though, is in a recent interview I did with you some time ago, we discussed weapons of mass destruction. We discussed whether or not there were actually weapons of mass destruction. We discussed whether Tony Blair and George W. Bush were justified in doing what they did. Is your take still the same? Do you believe the same as you did then? In other words, tell
me... I do think that Saddam had to be removed. I do think there were weapons of mass destruction.
Do you think or do you know?
I know, because I know the guys who removed them. And I'm sure they are in Syria. There may not have been the amount that we had been told existed, but Saddam Hussein had to be removed. I remember one night I was with my Mukhabara, the security man who watched me, and he said to me, Andrew, a very important meeting tonight. I said, who with? He wouldn't tell me. I said, where is it? I said, is it at the hunting club? He said, yes, at the hunting club. I said, is it with Uday Akwesi Hussein, the sons of Saddam? He said, it's with both. I said, I don't want to go then. He started to cry. I said, Jabba, why are you crying? He said, if you do not go, they will kill me and my family. And that really brought home to me how evil the previous regime was.
Why would they kill your security guard and his family because you didn't attend the meeting?
Because he had to deliver and he would be held responsible for not delivering. I had to be there, so I turned around to him And I said, I will go. And I went to the worst dinner party of my life.
What happened?
Well, they wanted clearly me to achieve certain things for them and to say certain things publicly. But I was, by this stage, used to hearing all these kind of things. But the problem was that these two had shiny suits. Never trust a man in a shiny suit.
How can you bring such humour to such devastation and tragedy is quite remarkable, Andrew.
Well, you have to be able to laugh, otherwise you'd never survive.
I mean, the whole issue surrounding Iraq and the whole issue, if we look up to date now where we are, we're in 2011 now, and if we look at the issue now, there's been a big inquiry on Iraq that has been going on for many, many months. Tony Blair has been called there twice. Was he justified, as far as you're concerned?
And they've been out to see me as well.
Who? What, the inquiry?
Chilcot inquiry, yes.
They've been to see you?
Yeah.
And did you give them this information?
I did. I told them exactly as I saw it. And I told them what really went wrong after the war was not the removal of Saddam. It was the issue that religion wasn't taken seriously. When religion goes wrong, it goes very wrong. Mm. And that's what has happened. This inquiry, the people involved in
the Chilcot inquiry,
are very, very good people. Sir John Chilcot, Sir Martin Gilbert, they are amazing people. Sir Martin Gilbert is Jewish. He's the foremost Holocaust theologian and historian in the world. The only thing wrong about him, he went to Oxford, not Cambridge. But God can even forgive that. Mm. But when he heard about our church and all that we were doing, the man who interviewed me for the Chilcot inquiry sent us money.
That's amazing.
For the church.
Now, given that you've given evidence to the Chilcot inquiry, are you that now saying that there will be some sort of vindication for Bush and Blair, or what? What are you saying on this?
I think that in the long term, we will see that what Bush and Blair did was actually right. Mm. I have a picture of Bush in the study in my home in England. And it was written by President Bush on the last day he was in the White House. And he said, I went into Iraq hoping I was doing the work of God. But you have been there in Baghdad doing the work of the Almighty. Mm. Thank you.
It's fantastic. I want to stay with Iraq for a moment because there are some wonderful stories of reconciliation there, wonderful stories of children especially that you've helped. And one that comes to my mind is a story about Dawood. How did you meet Dawood and how old was he?
Dawood, I met Dawood when he was 12. He was a young boy, and I found him sleeping in the back of an American tank on the streets in Baghdad. And Dawood, he learned English in 3 weeks from the American soldiers. So he speaks American. Mm. And he learned Spanish in 6 weeks from the Hispanic soldiers. And the other boys around the street, he was the only Christian boy, they said, you must go and see him. There's a priest over there. And he said, I'm not going to the priest. Priests are boring. And I eventually did meet him, and he became my best friend.
Yeah, but there was a wonderful story about him not having any food, and you fed him in a restaurant, and you
I've heard him from the time I first met him. He saved my life, clearly, a few times. And Dawood is now a man.
Mm.
He is still with me. He is my special assistant in Baghdad.
Wherever I go, he goes with me. Tell me about the first time that you fed him. You took him into a restaurant.
Well, it was wonderful. He couldn't believe that I would provide him food like this and that I really loved him and cared for him. And I not only took him into a restaurant, I took him to church with me the day we reopened church. It had been shut down from 91 to 2003 because it was known as the English Church. And from that day, he said to me, "Will you become my daddy?" I said, "Yes." So to this day, he still calls me daddy.
That's fantastic. You mentioned a church there. Of course, you're talking about St. George's.
Yes.
Where is St. George's in Baghdad now located?
St. George's is located where it's always been located because it's on British land. The government owned the land and it's right in the centre of Baghdad, 2 minutes from the Green Zone.
Is it not in one of Saddam's palaces?
No, I used to run services in Saddam's palaces.
But that you still called it St. George's, didn't you?
No.
Okay.
That was the chapel of the U.S. Embassy. The Republican Palace became the U.S. Embassy.
Mm.
Saddam's throne became the chaplain's chair.
Mm.
On the ceiling were the pictures of the New Jerusalem and the white horses. One side, there were Scud missiles painted on the wall. The other side was Jerusalem. And I used to have to do chapel in there.
Talk to me about the glory of God that has been very apparent in Iraq, certainly since you've been there. I've heard you talking on it many, many times.
Well, the glory of God is something which has always been very important to me, seeing God's glory, seeing his physical presence. And we have seen phenomenal things in Iraq. We have seen the glory of God like clouds. We have seen angels. We have seen orbs. And even in this book, which I've just written, called Faith Under Fire, you will see the funeral cars with the Christians all going through, the Christians killed, being taken to their funerals and surrounding the cars in the middle of the night is the cloud of glory. And it's so obvious. And so we see this all the time. We've seen incredible healings. We see the presence of God. And Dawood, who takes lots of the photographs, regularly comes to me. "Daddy says the pictures are no good because the angels are in the way. The glory is everywhere." And I tried saying to the angels, "Can you just leave us alone for 1 minute?"
Mm-hmm.
But no.
Why do you think that these manifestations are happening in Iraq at this moment?
I think because we really need the presence of God. We need it to get through each day. Mm. You know, angels in Iraq work overtime. They have a lot to do protecting us.
Mm.
And God's glory is always in evidence when everything else is gone.
Mm.
You know, I say in that book I've just written, I say, when you've lost everything, you realize that Jesus is all you have left.
Mm.
And our people have lost everything, but we haven't lost Jesus. We haven't lost his presence and we haven't lost his glory.
What about your members of staff, your personal members of staff? I have read recently that you've actually lost 11 personnel in 1 year.
Oh, that was in 1 day. All of our staff were killed. But 11 is another key number, because last year I baptized 13 adults and 11 of those were killed the following week. We have had so many people killed, massacred, kidnapped, tortured. And I admit there have been times when I've been in tears. It's just too awful. And the children come to me and say, "Don't worry, Daddy, because we all speak Aramaic, which is their language, not Arabic, Aramaic, the language of Jesus." Mm. And they said, "Jesus also speaks Aramaic, so they'll be able to talk to Jesus when they get there."
What about the church services in Iraq? They're supposed to be really special times.
They are incredibly special times. We can't fit everybody in our church at once, so we have services on Friday, Saturday and Sunday. And we start every service with the words, "Allahumma anna," "The Lord is here." And they shout back in Arabic, "His spirit is with us." And we have our services in Aramaic, Arabic, and English. We do all three.
There's a story that you told me some time ago that I remember very distinctly about an American colonel, I believe, who was involved. He was a urologist.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I'd forgotten about that.
That's story. Actually just come to me as we're speaking.
Yeah, there was a little girl called Vivian. I loved her so much. Mm. And she was very ill and had cancer in the bladder. And the radiotherapy machine in Iraq had broken. There was no treatment for her. I was with her on the Saturday. We used to worship then in the office of Prime Minister Nour al-Maliki. It's quite interesting having a service in a Shiite Prime Minister's office. And her father, Vivian's father, came to me after the service and said, "Is there anything you can do for my little girl?" And I said, "I will try. We will pray about it." And what we needed more than anything was a urologist. Anyway, the following day, I was taking the service in the American Embassy. And I was saying, "Goodbye, General. Goodbye, Major. Goodbye, Colonel." And then suddenly I saw somebody who was new. I said, "Good morning. What do you do in life?" He said, "I'm only working at the CASH." That means the Combat Army Support Hospital. I said, "What are you doing at the CASH?" He was a soldier and a surgeon. He said, "Oh, I'm only a urologist." I said, "You're precisely the only man I need in the world."
Oh, wow.
And he organized for us to, he saw little Vivian, he organized us to get her treated with a urologist in Jordan. But sadly, one day, the urologist phoned me and said, "Andrew, she can't see out of her left eye." I said, "What's happening?" He said, "We think she's got secondary tumours. And it had spread to her eye. And I used to go and see her and hold her hand and pray for her. She was so ill. She was dying then. and she would see the angel was coming to her at night. And she did die. And I said, why, Lord, why? Everything seemed as if it was right. The miracle of getting the surgeon we needed. And I took her funeral in Jordan. It was the hardest funeral I've ever taken in my life. Her family are now in France. They wouldn't have got there if it wasn't for Vivian. And for Vivian dying. I don't understand everything. But what I do understand is that despite however awful things are, God is always there.
What would your comment be then? Why would God let something like this happen? Why would he let a little girl like this die in such tragic
ways? I really believe now more than anything is that one day all of us have to go to heaven. And I think there's a very good assurance that those who God wants, he will take quickly sometimes.
Indeed. Let's move on now. I'm going to go back a few years to 2002. I want to talk about your involvement in quite an important issue in Israel, because you've been working in Israel as well as working in Iraq and the Middle East. And you'd been involved in the Alexandra Agreement.
Alexandra process was the first time that all the religious leaders from Israel got together, both Jewish, Muslim, and Christian. And I organized all of that, and it was chaired by George Carey when he was Archbishop of Canterbury. And we did have an incredible result getting these people together. And we continued working on it. And sadly, it became obvious that I couldn't keep doing Israel and Iraq. And we set up everything in Israel to keep the process going after I left. But it didn't work.
But in 2002, something interesting happened, and hostages were taken, and they were made captive in the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem.
Following Easter services, heavily armed Palestinian terrorists invade the Church of the Nativity and take priests and nuns hostage. These same Palestinians, who committed barbaric acts of terrorism in Israel, are now hiding behind the walls of this most sacred church, desecrating its sanctity and hindering its clergy in their religious practices.
Tell me about your involvement in that.
Well, it was quite interesting because I was in hospital at the time. I was ill. I had a recurrence in MS. And first of all, Yasser Arafat phoned me. He said, Abuna, Abuna, Father, come quickly, they've taken our church. I said, what do you mean? So he told me what had happened. And then the next phone call was from Michael Melchior, who was Deputy Foreign Minister of Israel. He said, Andrew, get here quickly. I told you if you left, something would happen like this. I said, I'm a bit tied up at the moment. He said, who do you work for, God or the Archbishop? Come here. So I dismissed myself and went there. And for 39 days, I negotiated. And to start with, for several weeks, we negotiated about negotiations. And finally, we got all the people out on day 39. I thought that was so long in those days. but what was to happen in Iraq would take a lot longer. I've been involved in many, many hostage cases, but we are still working on some, so I can't really talk about that. All I can say is when I got the Civil Courage Prize last year, in the audience was a young man who was somebody I had negotiated his release. I had never seen him. That was the first time I saw him. He knew I got him out, and it was wonderful seeing him after all these years, now living in America with his mother.
This was all, this hostage negotiation was all to do with your work as the special envoy for the Archbishop of Canterbury, which was...
Well, I wasn't then.
Yeah.
Because George Carey retired as Archbishop of Canterbury. Mm. And this work in Israel, it started through the Alexandria process, which was very much the Archbishop of Canterbury's then. But in Iraq, it was just my own particular work.
Let me... You mentioned these awards, and I've got a list here that is really very impressive. And we start... In 1991, the Sternberg International Council of Christians and Jews Prize, jointly with Lord Coggan. The Anglo-Israel Association Prize in 2001. Sir Sigmund Sternberg Interfaith Prize in 2003. Grand Commander of the Order of the Merit of the Knights Templar of Jerusalem, 2003. Interfaith Award, British Government, 2003. Peacemaker in Action Award, the Tannenbaum Center for Interreligious Understanding, United States, 2005. U.S. Cross of Valor in 2006. The Wolf Institute for Abrahamic Faiths, Cambridge Peace Prize, 2007. The Iraq Peace Prize, 2010. The International Civic Courage Prize, 2010. Honorary PhD, University of Gloucester, 2010. And you also tell me you've got two other PhDs, so you're a doctor three times over. So what do people call you? The Reverend Canon Dr. Andrew White?
It's quite funny. We had some boys over from Iraq at Christmas. Last summer. And they used to call me Haji Dr. Abuna. And all these different titles. But the most recent prize was the Civil Courage Award, which is a very big international prize. Mm. And it's quite funny because my wife said to me, that prize money I'm having. I'm having it to build a new kitchen.
Yeah.
And she did.
Oh, wonderful. That is great.
I've got a peace kitchen.
That is wonderful. Is that what you call it, the peace kitchen?
Yeah.
So you go and have a cup of coffee and you feel really peaceful.
The peace kitchen is just being built. It won't be finished until Friday.
I must come and see this.
You've got to come and see the peace kitchen.
Absolutely. I want to talk about, just for a little while, your associate pastorship, if you like, of the church in North Carolina, USA, with Mahesh and Bonnie Shavda. I know Mahesh and Bonnie very, very well. And there is a story that I've heard you talk about, which I absolutely love and adore. And it's when you got the children in North Carolina to make peace bangles. And there it is there. We'll get a shot of that in a moment.
All of our people in Iraq wear them. and it says Friends on them. Some of them have the children's initials. This one's got the initials of children from North Carolina and from St. George's, Baghdad. And everybody wears these things.
That's wonderful. That is fantastic. How did that come about, Andrew?
Do you really want to know?
Yes, please.
I don't know.
You don't know?
No.
You haven't got a clue, but it's still a great idea.
Yeah. One day, one of our congregation, he was a policeman, and he was blown up, and his body was blown to pieces, and I didn't know who it was. And then they saw a hand with the bracelet on, and they knew.
My goodness me. What work do you actually do in North Carolina?
Well, now I go very rarely. I'm not there very much. Mm. But I basically preach, speak at conferences. Mm. And their young people are very connected with our work. And some of them come and work for us. Our intern last year came from them.
Mm. Wonderful. Finally, talk to me about your aspirations. The one thing that I think is completely remarkable about you, and it's by the grace of God, is that you have contracted multiple sclerosis,
mm.
and still you work the amount you work. Still you are away the amount you are away. You are just such a credit.
Well, you know, with Daniel, he was taken by Nebuchadnezzar to be in exile in Babylon. But God gave him all that he needed to do the work he had to do. He enabled him to interpret the dreams of the king. And I always say to people, if you want to know what God is doing, the most important thing is for you to be where God has called you.
Mm.
If he has called you to a place, he will enable you to do the work. And a doctor came to me 2 years ago in Baghdad, of all places. He said, Abuna, Andrew, I need to make you better. You're getting worse. I said, oh, yes, how are you going to do it? He said, I've looked it up on Google. You need stem cell treatment. I said, oh, yes, but I have ethical problems with it. Oh, he said, no, I want to take it from your own stem cells. I said, have you done this before? He said, no. I said, when do you want to do it? He said, tomorrow. It worked. I've now had this treatment 22 times over the past 2 and a bit years, and I'm completely different to what I used to be, and I continue to be able to do what God has called me to do, because he has resourced me and he has enabled me.
That is fantastic. So what are your aspirations now? At this point in your life, what do you feel God is calling to you to? You're going to continue with your work, but where do you think that's going to take you?
I really do not know. All I know is that God has called me to be where I am at the moment, which is in Iraq. He who has called you will not fail you. And I listen to God every day, and I tell my people, I'm not leaving you, please don't leave me. And I will stay with them as long as God wants me to.
Andrew White, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The Vicar of Baghdad, presented and produced by David Aldous, edited by Martin Jordan. This has been a David Aldous Media production. To you by IFP Global, for ministries who have a vision to expand their physical presence to other parts of the world. Contact IFP Global at admin@ifpglobal.com. IFP Global is